Access number 29537, Mr. Albert Arndt's Reel 11. Now, so what happens next then? You know, you've done this first working party. Did you do any more, or was that just a special?
That was just a special thing, yes.
So what happened next then?
Well, camp routine went on, and the year came to an end.
Any Christmas celebrations?
We had the Christmas celebration, yes, the usual. Christmas tree was organised, you know, in the dining room or in the recreation room. Cakes were baked, and I cannot remember whether it was so or not. It might have been. It might be written down. I don't know whether we actually got any parcels from home or any parcels from the Red Cross. I just cannot remember this at the moment.
Now, you then seem to have gone on to a working camp in Romford.
Yes.
Now, tell me about that one.
Then that was the time after Christmas. Of course, the understanding was, which was made known to us later, we were to stay in this country for 3 years. And as there was a great shortage of labour, especially men, either in agriculture, in the building industry, construction industry, we were used to help to build out, I suppose, what we had damaged. Okay. So we were again sorted out into different working gangs, and every morning after breakfast, it must have been between 8 and 9 or so, our gang, to which I belonged, we were loaded in a big lorry, and we were driven through Stratford, Walthamstow, and places like this onto the Eastern Avenue up to Romford. And there was a big building site, and we were given shovels and, you know, tools for working, and we were given to some British foreman, and they told us exactly what we had to do. We learned how to dig trenches, we learned how to level them out, we learned how to make the foundations, and they were all prefabs. And according to some of the notes I have made, of course, many, many years later, we built something like 809 prefabs in Romford. Some Harold Hill way. You know, we did all the drainage, we did all the foundations, and then the bricklayers came and all the British workers, and they built up the prefabs. So we moved along from one end of that building site to the other. We were treated well. What we, of course, did in our spare time in the evenings and weekends to supplement our... We were actually paid in camp money. We were not allowed to have sterling, English money. We were paid in camp money through which we could buy our toilet articles and some cigarettes and bits and pieces in the camp canteen. But we were also very keen to have some English money. I know we were not really allowed to have it. So we made all sorts, in our spare time, we made all sorts of things. We made tools, toys. My friend and me, we made... Oh,
it's all right.
I'm sorry.
Now, you've just gone and fetched a rather lovely ship in a bottle.
Yeah.
You made that at the time, did you?
Yes. During our submarine training in the Baltic, there were some other ships there, German ships there as well. And we got friendly with some possibly Chinese people who worked on these ships in the laundry. And these Chinese taught me how to put ships in a bottle, in a proper Why?
It's rather wonderful. It's pretty detailed. It's got rigging, all the sails, all the masts and everything.
Yes, yes.
Looks fantastic. And that's one you made at the time. You made that Easter 1954, so that's a bit later. But yeah, but that's the sort of thing you made.
And my friend Robert and me, we got in to make these ships in the bottle. So we hunted around for bottles because they had to be clear. They had to be without bubbles, you know, sort of nice-looking bottles. And we organized empty flour bags as sails because it had to be very fine linen and well, the wood you can get anywhere. And we usually had about half a dozen of these ships in bottles in various stages in the camp. And when they were finished, we sold these for £1 each.
Which was quite a lot of money then.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And that was to get sterling?
That was to get sterling, yes. And other, you know, other chaps made toys and all sorts of things, baskets, slippers. You'd be surprised, wouldn't it? So, that was our spare time occupation.
Now, what happened next then? What's the next thing? I mean, you work, it must be quite hard work on the building sites.
Well, it was hard work in the beginning, but of course you got used to it. And it was actually good because, you know, you had physical exercise, you used your muscles as you should do. You always had a good appetite, you were hungry.
Do you remember how you made the prefabs? Because the whole thing is they're prefabricated. Do you remember how you actually did it? I should have asked before, but...
Well, we, the prisoner boards, we did all the drainage. You know, it was called laying pipes, the drainage. And we did the foundation.
Oh, so you didn't actually fit the
No, that was made by the experts. Okay. Yes. There were two types of prefabs. One was the English type and one was the American type. They were different in design and different in material. But the English type, they're actually, believe it or not, if you go down to Dulwich, near the Dulwich Library, there are still two or three left. Slightly different to what they were originally. That was quite a good time. Not so nice during the winter. You know, when it was cold and rainy and you had to stand in the mud and dig. But there you are.
Now you were caught with currency on you, weren't you? Tell us that story.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, nobody... including ourselves, we like to be sort of deceived, as it were. We always like to be on top of things, as we were not allowed really to have sterling. We had occasionally, there were spot checks when we came home from work. Instead of going to our quarters, we had to go to the football ground, and we were searched. And of course, quite often, money was found, and that was confiscated. So I remember once, you know, as the months and the years went by, it got easier and easier, and nobody worried anyway. On one occasion, I had actually one of these nice crisp. You remember what the old £5 notes looked like?
The big ones.
Huge white things, yes. And I folded it up and had it in my hand. And when he said, you know, we had to put our hands up in the search pockets, and then I had in my hand.
And oh, so you weren't caught?
No, I weren't caught. I wasn't caught. And I remember when the captain said, you know, there is nobody in this camp who can put wool over my eyes. We always find out. And we had such a laugh after us.
So you were never actually caught?
I wasn't, no. But as I said, as the months or so in the years went by, it petered out.
And the last one you ever made was one you just showed me that you made in 1954, but that's typical of the sort you did.
Yeah.
You gave that to your wife.
I made this, well, we were not married then. We were courting. I thought I'd show my skills and make it a bottle.
Now, so what happened next then? You're doing this throughout most of 46, from the looks of things.
Yes.
Living in Stratford Camp,
yeah.
And working in Romford.
That's right.
Now, any stories, anything else that you remember? Or is it just a matter of routine?
It was more a matter of routine. Of course, we met quite a number of English people.
Civilians?
Sorry?
Civilians?
Civilians, yes.
How did you get on with them?
Well, I mean, in the beginning, there was a certain shyness. I mean, they didn't really know what we were like, and we didn't know what they were like. And, I mean, if you work in outside amongst, you know, other people, where other people live, you're bound to come in touch with some now and then. It was nice. Of course, it tried to chat up the girls as well, obviously. We worked for a good while at Romford. Later on, I and some others were transferred to the Chingford camp for a while, because there was a new building site going up in Chingford. And we did exactly the same. We did drainage, foundations, but the houses were not prefabs anymore. They were proper houses. And over the last 2 or 3 years, my wife and I made 2 visits up there, and houses are still there.
That you built?
Which we built.
Or did the drainage for again, yeah?
Yeah.
So you went to the Chingford outstation. Anything else? What happened? Anything happened there?
Nothing in particular. Of course, at that time, I think it started from Christmas 1946 onwards. We were allowed to actually go out.
From Christmas 46
out of the camp in our spare time.
Now tell, so you were, you know, as free men, well,
yeah,
as just you were allowed out. Tell me what
you
did.
You know, we had our prisoner of war uniform.
Ah, well, let's do that. What was your prisoner of war?
Well, it was battle dress. It was khaki battle dress, but there was sort of a huge square in the back of the battle dress blouse, as it were, was cut out. And either a blue or red or yellow patch was sewn on there. And also on one trouser leg, the same happened. So that distinguished us from being prisoner of war. So at first, of course, we had to wear these things when we were allowed to go out. The first time we were allowed to go out, I remember it, my friend Robert and me and some others. We walked all the way, and of course we were not allowed to go use transport. We didn't have money, anything like this. It was all done by on foot. We walked all along Carpenter's Road, up to Stratford Broadway, down Mile End Road, because we have heard of Tower Bridge, Buckingham Palace, you know, places like this. We wanted to see them. So we walked actually down there to look at Tower Bridge. That was beautiful. Really beautiful embankment, as it was in those days.
Now, so what happened? Anything else about going out? I mean, you officially had no money.
Well, in the beginning we didn't, but gradually we had money, so we could buy little things here and there. We actually used to go down to Petticoat Lane, and we bought shoes, and we also bought things like stockings, you know, to send home. We actually sent quite a few bits home. We bought coffee, cocoa, which and cigarettes, which we were allowed to send home, funnily enough. And, you know, especially in East Germany, which was absolutely terrible, people had nothing at all. For a packet of cigarettes, I mean, you could buy anything. So that was a help to my mother over at home.
Now, did you have a girlfriend locally?
Oh, we had girlfriends, yes. Yes, we had girlfriends. Oh. I think one girl one girl was called Daisy. She lived somewhere in Hackney. And one was called Doris. She also lived somewhere on the other. You know, the not far from one end of our camp was that great Victoria Park. And we used to go there quite a lot because there were things going on. There was music, band playing, there was dancing and roller skating. And we used to nip down there. It's only about 10 minutes walk from the camp in the evenings. Of course, we met girls down there.
Was there any resentment from the locals to you going out with British girls, or was it mostly accepted?
Probably in the beginning there was a bit of resentment. I remember that, you know, when we actually were allowed to go out, that we were told by some people we were not fit to walk on the pavement, we had to walk in the gutter. Later on, when we were able actually to make friends, and we made lots of friends, English families, they probably felt sorry for us, I don't know, but they invited us for Sunday dinner, things like that, and they gave us money for the bus fare. And I remember that one or the other bus conductor refused to take us on the bus because we were...
So it was mixed.
Partly understandable, but it gradually got easier and easier as the months went by. When I was in the camp in Chingford, well, I think that is also something worthwhile mentioning. Probably during 46, when we got quite a number of additional prisoner of war in our camp, but they all came from America. See, they were actually told they were going home, but they landed up in England. And one of my friends, one chap, came into Chingford camp. His cousin lived in Dulwich. She was married to a British officer, Air Force officer. And being his cousin, he and me, we went weekends to Dulwich. I mean, they gave us money for the fares. We had dinner there. They took us out in the car. And we were very well off, and they gave us things, you know, extra food and cigarettes and bits and pieces. So that was quite a good time.
Now, what about this trip to Brighton? You seem to have gone on, Hove, Brighton.
Yes, it was my first trip in an English car. It was a large Wolseley, like the old police cars used to be, Wolseley police cars. And one Sunday morning, they decided to go down to Brighton, Hove, and we of course were invited to go with him, Gunther, my friend and me. We actually took our swimming trunks and we were all on the beach there, swimming, laying in the sunshine. That was nice. That was very nice.
Now, what happened next then?
Well, I mean, the time went on. We did mostly on the building side. There was a time when, that was probably early 1948, when already repatriation started. The camp gradually became...
How did you feel? Were you sort of dying, really looking forward to it, or were you worried about going back to the Soviet zone? What did you feel?
It was sort of a bit 50-50, because there were maybe a handful of chaps from our camp. One was a baker. One was an electrician, you know, qualified people. They actually decided to stay in England. And I think there were certain rules where you actually could stay in England. I was not sure what I really should do.
You thought of staying in England?
I had thought of it. But then there was that sort of feeling, I was the oldest, you see, in the family, that mother was on her own, you know, father was dead. I had two younger brothers, and in the end, I opted to be repatriated home to Germany, which was, well, as it turned out, it wasn't really the right thing to have done.
Now, so what was the situation? How was the repatriation organised? It started in 1948.
I think it started sort of in round about March or something, 1948. And I think by May it was supposed to be completed, that all the prisoner of war were to be repatriated. Well, you were taken off, you got every week, so-and-so was going home. I was repatriated in May, beginning of May 1948.
Now, what was the procedure for repatriation?
Well, you got your orders, you got all your paperwork. You were told the date when you were actually to be repatriated. When you had to leave the camp, we were collected again in a lorry, we were taken to Liverpool Street. We were taken to, what's that place near Harwich? We went actually from Harwich. There was another sort of camp where you were sorted out. And then we were taken from Harwich to Hoek of Holland, put on a train. And that went right through Holland into Germany. The people who lived, whose home was in the western part of Germany, whether it was British, American or French occupied zone, they were then taken off. And we were taken to a camp, I think it was called Friedland, which is near the Harz Mountains. That was very near the frontier between East and West. And then we were marched across the frontier. On one day we were marched across the frontier into, you know, through no man's land. There was quite a big stretch, which was called no man's land, into East Germany. There we had to stay again for about 2 or 3 days in a kind of a hostel before they let us go home to our hometowns.
Now, what was life like when you got back to Erfurt, which is not your original hometown? It was your hometown.
Well,
now,
that's where I was born, actually, yeah, but I didn't really. But I knew it, but not that well. Well, I got home. It was a sunny day. My mother was working in, you know, she worked in an office. I think my brothers were still at school. So the last years, they were still at school. I got home. Everything was strange because I had never. My mother lived in a flat. I didn't know anybody. I didn't know the place. You know, it was sort of a numb feeling. You knew you were home, but you didn't. Really, and you had to go through all the rigmarole to go to this authority, and you get your ration cards there, and you get to whatever. And you know, you have that sensing. Of course, then when you talk person to like my mother, my uncle, they could tell me what it was really like in East Germany. My mother couldn't write to me in the letter, and it was horrible. All the Russians about, you know, they like their drink, don't they? A lot of drunken Russian, and you couldn't say anything to them. There was fear. It was really fear over there.
And were you aware of this straight away? You know that.
Well, you had a sensing. You know, that sort of like a dark cloud hanging over you, even if you couldn't identify yet what it really was. But then as you got to know the setup. I mean, there was absolutely nothing. You were treated like nothing. You had nothing to eat. The rations we got, they were so little. You know, you were always hungry. During the winter time, fortunately, it was only one winter I spent over there. We had no fuel. When I came home from work, I had to go to bed just to keep warm. There just was nothing. Absolutely nothing. There were no shops, no nothing. Now, I had to work, being an engineer.
Tell me about your work. How did they find your work?
Well, I didn't find it. I was given it. When I had registered with all the authorities.
What did that involve, registration?
Well, all your details, where you were, what you've done, what you are. I mean, everything they could get out of you, really, in devious ways, I suppose. That was all put, you had your record. And you got also your political grading, as it were. You know, under the communist rule. I mean, if you are not for us, you must be against us. So you couldn't sit on the fence.
So what was the political grading? What did you get, or what did it mean?
Well, for instance, I had to register under the Labour, call it Labour Exchange. Now, they saw I was an engineer, so I had to work at the Olympic typewriter place, manufacturing factory in Erfurt. I was given a job as a toolmaker, or tool fitter, really, it was called tool fitter.
And that
well, you got your rules there. You must be there. You must do that. I mean, it was all I remember about that time. I already can feel it in my stomach. I was always hungry. I had to go to work. You came home.
So the work was pretty low. You were qualified better than that, weren't you?
Well, I mean, I knew what I was doing. I could do what was required. It was more, I think it was in comparison a bit primitive, because you see what the Russians did, instead of demolishing a lot of factories, machinery, and take it to Russia, I suppose they did in some way, but they left it where they are, where the place was. They put a Russian commissar in charge of it. And sort of 90%, 90 to 95% of the production that was produced went to Russia. And the rest was for us. When there was any complaints, I remember on one occasion when we sort of complained as far as we were allowed to complain, that we didn't have any shoes to wear, that we couldn't buy any shirts and trousers and things because there wasn't anything. And that man, that Russian, commissar, he said to us, well, when I look out of the windows and see you people walking about, you're always so clean, you're always so well-dressed, you don't need anything else. That was the attitude. You know, if I wanted a pair of shoes, you can't go in a shop because there weren't any shops. I had to go to my foreman, explained I need a pair of shoes. He saw the next one up in authority, and if he thought it was right for me to have a pair of shoes, I got a certificate, and I go to a certain place, and I got a pair of shoes, which of course the quality wasn't all that good. There was just nothing.
And what about the food shortages?
Oh. You got a hunk of bread, you got a slab of butter per week, you got usually what you were supposed to get, a bit of meat, or wasn't available, so you got an egg instead. Honestly, we were always hungry. Always hungry.